18-year-old Jennifer Pentala had made her decision. After a mission trip to Mexico, she wanted to go back again. That opportunity presented itself when a trip was organized to ride bikes down from San Diego. While those plans eventually fell through, Jennifer decided she was going to do it on her own. In October of 1991, she began her journey with plans to be gone for 5 months. In the beginning, things went well. However, everything changed 2 weeks later. In her final phone call home, Jennifer said she changed her mind and wanted to go to Minnesota to visit a friend before coming home to Montana. She told her mother she'd call back the next day to finalize plans, but that call never came and Jennifer vanished. Nearly a year later, many of her belongings were discovered in the middle of the desert, away from the direction she was last known to be heading. What happened to Jennifer Pentala? Did she fall victim to a random act of violence? Was she targeted by a notorious killer? Or is it possible that she could still be out there somewhere? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 144, The Disappearance of Jennifer Pentala. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the truly haunting and mysterious disappearance of Jennifer Pentala. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions there or directly email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. A high school graduate decides to take a year off from college to do mission work and disappears. A year later, the only clues to her whereabouts are discovered, but they leave more questions than answers. This is episode 144, The Disappearance of Jennifer Pentala. As the sun slowly rose over southwestern New Mexico, it was promising to be another sweltering day, with temperatures in the upper 90s. Seemingly endless blue skies spanned over the Chihuahuan Desert, where State Road 26 cuts a thin gray line through the sands, running from Deming in the west to Hatch in the east. There isn't much in the way of sights to see along the two-lane road, beyond the landscape dotted with green brush and dark, shady blots beneath mesquite trees. However, 3 days into dove hunting season, it isn't uncommon to see folks out roaming the barren landscape, seeking their prey. That's exactly what brought one couple into the area one September morning, though their hunt would yield a result they couldn't possibly have imagined. Approximately 7 miles to the west of Hatch, a mile and a half or so off State Road 26, the two hunters came upon a strange scene. In the shade of a mesquite tree, they saw what appeared to be part of a tent, folded up over a few lumps hidden beneath. As they pulled back the material, they discovered several items that appeared out of place. Perhaps it wasn't so much the items, but the way in which they were organized, stacked neatly as though their owner had just walked away. Assuming that the owner was in the area and planning to return, the couple didn't think too much more about it, and they certainly didn't want to cause any issues by going through someone else's camp. As they moved on, though, they couldn't help but discuss how strange it had seemed. It wasn't typical to find a campsite in the desert like that, not to mention the almost haunting way things had been left so neatly organized, as though someone had put them there and then vanished. The more they thought about it, the more it bothered them, and when they returned to town, they decided to call authorities, notifying them of what they had seen. Initially, they were told an official would come out and take a look, and that satisfied them for a time. However, when they were back in the area a few days later, they took another look. To their surprise, they found everything exactly as they had left it. Frustrated, the couple made the decision to see if they could find anything out by taking a look at the items for themselves. They reached for the two backpacks, both of which appeared to be in good condition, if not slightly faded due to use and exposure. Unzipping the packs, the two hunters didn't find much to help solve the mystery, until they found a book. Inside that book were numbers with names. Amongst the items discovered was a wallet. Inside was a Montana driver's license issued to a Jennifer Pentala. Getting back on the phone, the hunters dialed the number and explained to the person on the other end what they had found. There was an immediate reaction, and when they read off the name on the license, the woman on the other end let out a gasp. Jennifer Pentala's family had last heard from her nearly a year earlier, in October of 1991, when she had mysteriously vanished on a solo biking trip. The items found in the desert were the first major clues in a case which had so far ushered in a year of pain and desperation. Excitement was soon overwhelmed by concern, though. Why were Jennifer's things found so far off the main road? And where exactly was the missing 18-year-old? Jennifer Lynn Pentala was born on March 4, 1973 to parents Nicholas and Lynn. Born and raised in Montana, Jennifer has been described by everyone in her life as smart, attentive, and a kind young woman who was driven to reach out and assist others. When Jennifer was 2 years old, her family welcomed in their second child, a younger sister named Carrie. By all accounts, Jennifer adored her sister, and since the two were close in age, they spent much of their childhoods together, playing and having fun. While Jennifer enjoyed a good laugh, there was one area of her life which she took extremely seriously and would ultimately devote herself to: God. Jennifer was a devout Lutheran and believed in doing whatever she could to help and support others. She steered clear of troubling situations and lived a strict lifestyle. Her grandmother later described her to the Montana Standard, saying, quote, "She didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't chase, just a plain Jane girl," end quote. Jennifer's mother would agree with those sentiments, for the most part, though she'd add in that her daughter wasn't the ordinary girl and was the type that once she made up her mind about something, it was difficult, if not impossible, to pull it back. This certainly was true when it came to her adventurous spirit and desire to see the world while helping others. During her junior year at Great Falls High School, Jennifer became fascinated with the possibility of going out into the world through an exchange program where she might experience other cultures. Through the Open Door program, Jennifer would spend 4 weeks during the summer of 1990 in Ivory Coast, West Africa. Excited for the trip, her mother found there was no talking her out of it, although it wouldn't be quite what Jennifer expected. Speaking with the Great Falls Tribune, Lynn explained her daughter was disappointed to find herself hosted in a large, beautiful home, saying, quote, "She would rather have been in little huts with the people helping them out," end quote. Either way, it was a trip which changed Jennifer's life and gave her a desire to do more. While Jennifer had been gaining experience out in the world and sharpening her focus on what she wanted to do, she would soon come to understand the grief and pain of loss. In October of 1990, as Jennifer was entering her senior year of high school, her father lost his battle with cancer and passed away at the age of 44. While Jennifer struggled, as all children do, with the loss of a parent, she was able to find comfort in her faith, and that is something she would turn to time and time again. When asked about how Jennifer handled the loss of her father, Lynn explained, quote, "Jennifer told me that it was meant to be, that God had work for Nick to do in heaven," end quote. Graduating with honors in the spring of 1991, Jennifer, now 18, was setting into action her plans for adulthood. Her mother had remarried a man she had known since high school, and the family moved from Great Falls to Missoula, the second largest city in the state. However, Jennifer wasn't planning on staying very long. She had already made plans to join a mission group through the church, which would take her and others south into Mexico. There, she would contribute to the community by painting and repairing churches, as well as ministering to and taking part in community outreach programs, where she would work side by side with locals, becoming immersed in Mexican culture. In a journal entry dated July 11, 1991, Jennifer wrote about the first day of her adventure, saying, quote, "I feel very in place, and I certainly don't feel alone. It's the neatest feeling to be right where God wants you. The whole trip down here, I could feel his presence. He was holding my hand. I left Missoula not knowing if anyone even knew I was coming, but I prayed, and I knew that no matter what, God would provide. I never felt extreme fear or anxiety, nothing but simple calm assurance that God was taking care of everything." End quote. The trip was a success, and Jennifer would return home to Montana, excited about the possibility of getting back to Mexico far sooner than she had initially planned. While she was supposed to go on to attend Concordia College in Minnesota that fall, she changed plans when she heard about another mission trip. This one would take her to San Diego, where she and a group would ride their bikes down into Mexico. It was a long journey, to be sure, but once she decided on it, Jennifer was dedicated. A graduation gift from her mother and sister would lock things into place when she received a brand new Fuji brand mountain bike. She began making plans, but things fell through. The group she was supposed to go to the mission with backed out, but Jennifer was no quitter and made the choice to go forward by herself. Lynn and James, Jennifer's stepfather, tried countless times to talk the 18-year-old out of it, but she'd made up her mind, and there was no going back. Jennifer was aware that her friends and family were concerned, and she struggled with an inability to fully explain her desire to get back to Mexico. In a journal entry dated September 9th, she wrote, quote, "Lord, I'm so frustrated. I know what I need to do, but nothing seems to be working out. Nobody wants to take me seriously, and it really hurts. Mexico is something very real to me, and I just wish someone would understand. I'm not trying to be a rebel or hurt anyone, but that's how everyone's making it out to be, and I can't seem to explain it right. I know people are just trying to be helpful. I need to do what I feel is right, what I think you want me to do, not what they want. It just seems like a joke. Lord, please guide me. I can't do this alone." End quote. The journal entries continue over the next week or so, where it seems Jennifer was somewhat wrestling with the idea. While she wanted very much to go to fly to San Diego and begin the bike trip on her own, she also admits being afraid and begs for guidance and help. On September 16th, Jennifer seemingly decided that she was going to take the trip, writing, quote, "I think it's time I let God lead me through. It's reality. I really feel confined here. It's time I told everyone that I'm for sure leaving. I should have done it sooner." End quote. Jennifer flew out of Missoula in late September, taking along everything she felt she would need for her trip, which included her mountain bike, helmet, two Bibles, one in Spanish, a camera, Walkman, maps, tent, sleeping bag, camping supplies, clothes, and $450 in cash. Jennifer's exact travel plans have been the source of a lot of confusion through much of the reporting I've dug into on this case. However, the combination of her journal and articles written specifically by people who spoke directly with her mother have worked well to uncloud some of that obscurity. An article written in the Missoulian explains that Jennifer was planning to bike southeast from San Diego, arriving in Hermosillo, Mexico, more than 500 miles away. She then planned to continue on to Guadalajara, an additional 1,000 miles. Her plans were scheduled in such a way that she had no intention of returning to Missoula until sometime in March, approximately 5 months after she began the trip. However, things would change early on. On Saturday, October 5th, Jennifer wrote in her journal that she'd crossed the Mexican border and made it to Tecate, approximately 44 miles south of San Diego. Here, Jennifer apparently ran into someone she knew who had been on several mission trips to Mexico for Christian Outreach Appeal, or COA, a non-denominational nonprofit focused on outreach to the homeless community. While her original plan was to ride southeast through the desert onto the Mexico side of the border, the friend warned her that it wasn't safe to do so as a lone woman. She went on to write, quote, "We discussed a lot, and I've decided to not travel through the Mexican desert. I'm going to do that part in the States," end quote. Early on in the trip, Jennifer was calling her mother almost every day. Those conversations, combined with journal entries, tell us that the following night, Saturday, October 6th, Jennifer recrossed the border back into the United States and spent her first night camping alone in the small California town of Potrero, some 5.5 miles to the northeast of Tecate. In her October 6th entry, she wrote, quote, "I've decided I would try for a week, and if by then, if I don't feel God pushing me on, I'm going to head back to Tecate and do some volunteer work for COA," end quote. Jennifer explained that she went to Sunday service that morning with her friend and then began biking east, but she got a late start, and by 11:30 a.m., it was already blistering hot. In her journal, she notes that the ride was mostly uphill and difficult, so she stopped in a town approximately 8 miles away. According to Google Maps, the only town within that range would be Campo, California. In her journal, she wrote that she made camp there, called her mother, and made some dinner before calling it a night. There is some confusion here, though, since in her next journal entry on Sunday, October 7th, she reports that her next town is 12 miles away, and it's Campo. It may be possible that she went back to Tecate to have breakfast with her friend, and then came back to her campsite before making the trip to Campo, which would make it approximately 12 miles. Either way, her journal puts her in Campo on the 7th. Here, she ate lunch in a shady area near a museum and then decided to continue on. But right as she was getting ready to go, one of her tires got a flat, so she got sidetracked going to a local hardware store to repair it. She didn't get back to riding until after 1 p.m., and noted that, about a mile up the road, she stopped at a gas station to find out how far it was to the next town. While there's no way of knowing for sure, there is a gas station at the intersection of Campo Road and Buckman Springs Road. According to her journal, an employee at the station told her the next town was 9 miles away and almost entirely uphill. With it being late in the day, Jennifer returned to the museum, planning to spend the night there. However, she ran into a Mexican family who gave her some food. While talking with the family, she explained that she was hoping to make her way to Nogales, Arizona, nearly 500 miles away. One member of the family offered a ride to her to El Centro, where they were heading, approximately 80 miles to the east. Jennifer wrote, quote, "I quickly said yes, and my bike and I piled into the back of their pickup. God knew I hated those mountains. I could feel him smile. What a ride, but a ride at that. They let me off at a gas station in El Centro, and I found my way to the Lutheran church," end quote. The church was locked when she arrived, but Jennifer decided to make camp nearby. At this point, her journal skips an entire week, with the next entry being Monday, October 14th, 3 days before she would vanish. This is Jennifer's last entry. While Jennifer had called her mother 8 times between the 1st and 13th, she wouldn't call again until the 17th. Her final round of calls came from Phoenix, Tucson, and later Wilcox, according to the Missoulian. In this last journal entry, she explained that she took a bus to Tucson. She met a man who took her to a Lutheran church, and she spent the night there in a preschool classroom. If indeed she left Wilcox on the 13th, her trip to Deming would be another 140 miles, though we have no information about what may or may not have occurred during that leg of the trip, nor anyone Jennifer may have run across who might have given her a ride. On Thursday, October 17th, Jennifer finally called home after 4 days of no communication. This call came from a gas station on Pine Street in Deming. The tone of her voice had changed, and apparently, so had her plans. At this point, she told Lynn that she was no longer planning to ride down into Mexico and instead was going to start heading north. She dearly missed her close friend Michelle, who had gone on to Concordia College, as Jennifer had originally planned, and now she was thinking that's where she would head, 1,392 miles to Minnesota, and then home to Missoula. Lynn didn't fully understand why Jennifer had changed her mind, later telling reporters, quote, "I had a hard time believing she would change her mind like that, but I was a little relieved that she might be heading home," end quote. Jennifer's journal may offer some insight here. Her final two entries go into several different situations she found herself in, where she was beginning to question the Christian standards of the people she was meeting. In her final entry, she wrote, quote, "I wound up at the Methodist church, where a kind elderly couple agreed to put me up for the night. It was very generous, but I felt like they were doing it because they felt obligated, rather than out of Christian love. I really haven't had good feelings about the churches here, and it makes me wonder about the state of Christianity in this country," end quote. She went on to note people being rude to her, staring at her, or ignoring her. In her final sentence, she noted that the woman who allowed her to stay in the preschool room was nice, but she ends her journal with, quote, "I wish I could say the same for the pastor and other members," end quote. Lynn was worried about Jennifer's plans, not just because of the distance, but heading north that late in the year, she was surely to run into bitterly cold temperatures as well as snow and other obstacles. In hopes of assisting her daughter, Lynn offered to purchase a bus ticket so Jennifer could get up to Minnesota, but the 18-year-old wasn't sure. She had to decide for herself. Jennifer told Lynn she would call back the next day or maybe 2 days later with her decision. According to the Missoulian, Jennifer intended to proceed on to Las Cruces, 63 miles to the east, and would call from there. Unfortunately, that call would never come, and Jennifer would disappear sometime between Thursday the 17th and Saturday the 19th. Saturday was Lynn's birthday, and when Jennifer failed to call, she couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. At first, Lynn tried to convince herself that Jennifer simply might not have access to a phone, but as the weekend came to a conclusion, she knew it was something bad. Ultimately, a missing persons report was filed through the Missoula Police Department, who then contacted police in New Mexico. It was noted, though, that while the Las Cruces police were helpful, the Deming police seemed to have little interest in working the case. In mid-November, Lynn and her husband flew to New Mexico and went to Deming to look for Jennifer. They brought missing persons flyers and, according to the Missoulian, spent a great deal of time visiting pawn shops and bike shops while searching along all major and back roads for any sign of Jennifer. With the assistance of the New Mexico authorities, Lynn did manage to speak with a gas station attendant who was working when Jennifer made her final call. That man, later identified as Jesus Vasquez, or Chewy as he was called, remembered seeing Jennifer and speaking with her. Reportedly, Vasquez was able to accurately describe what Jennifer was wearing and stated that she used the restroom, purchased a Coke, and used the payphone. According to a statement from Lynn, Vasquez claimed that he told Jennifer she had a nice bike and asked her where she was going, to which he says she replied, "Mexico." This was a confusing detail, as Jennifer had already decided at this point to go north. Other witnesses added to the confusion, as some recalled seeing Jennifer and noted her as heading northeast, while others stated that she headed south and had asked for directions towards Mexico City. Unfortunately, most of the witnesses couldn't recall exact dates of when they had seen Jennifer, making it possible she hadn't yet decided to go north when she spoke to them. Sadly, after 6 days in Deming, Lynn returned home no closer to finding her daughter. While the family tried to hang on to hope, they had their good days and their bad. Some days, Lynn believed Jennifer went to Mexico and would call one day, explaining how she'd got so involved with what she was doing, she'd lost track of time. Other days, she believed either someone had taken her daughter or perhaps murdered her. Nearly a year would pass with no developments before the two hunters found Jennifer's supplies. When located, her belongings were in an area north of Highway 26, approximately 7 miles to the southwest of Hatch. The site where they were found was just off a dirt road near an area that was used as an unofficial dumping ground. The dove hunters found the site on Friday, September 4th, 1992. While they located some of Jennifer's belongings, searches conducted by investigators working in tandem with a Donna Ana-based search and rescue team turned up many more. The vast majority of items that were in Jennifer's possession were recovered, though it was noted that her sleeping bag, bike, and money were missing. While police did find 83 cents and a single Mexican peso, Jennifer had noted her money supply as being $300.45 in her last accounting. State police conducted multiple searches over the course of several days, though beyond the items initially found, they couldn't find any trace of Jennifer, even after a 4-hour search using bloodhounds. This particular location added even more confusion to the case. Jennifer had intended to arrive in Las Cruces, which would have been directly to the east, rather than taking State Road 26, which led northeast towards Hatch. There was a path to follow, but it may have sent her on to Interstate 10, and she noted in her journal previously that bikes weren't allowed on the interstate. Perhaps that explains why her belongings were found off 26. It's also possible she could have made a mistake or someone had given her bad directions. Maybe even someone gave her a ride that purposefully took her in the wrong direction. That is, assuming the items were left by Jennifer and not placed there by someone else. John Holguin of the state police told the Albuquerque Journal that they'd be concluding their search unless some new information was found. When asked what he thought, Holguin told the El Paso Times, quote, "It doesn't tell me anything for sure. I can guess a lot of stuff and speculate, but right now, I don't know. I'm hoping that media publicity will generate some additional tips and information that will help us go on with this investigation." End quote. It was noted that while nothing was found to lead to Jennifer, nothing was found which specifically pointed towards foul play either. In fact, several items of value were left amongst Jennifer's belongings, which investigators thought could suggest she hadn't been the victim of a robbery or attack. Unfortunately, shortly after the discovery, her case began growing cold. There aren't many, if any, updates to deliver after 1992. Jennifer's family continued to work to keep her name in the spotlight, went down to New Mexico every year to search, and maintained close contact with investigators. In October of 98, Lynn and James appeared on The Maury Show to discuss Jennifer's case and speak with a psychic, though their hopes to get on more serious shows like Unsolved Mysteries were never answered. Following the show appearance, Lynn received a call from a woman who claimed to have met Jennifer in San Francisco, though no one was ever able to confirm the sighting. There were other sightings, reportedly of Jennifer living in New Mexico, though none of them could be confirmed either. There's a detail on many sites which suggests Jennifer may be in the company of a woman named Teresa, though where that originates from, I can't tell you. It's on several sites, including the Charlie Project, but I couldn't find any information to explain where that comes from. Police have never come close to a suspect or a person of interest, at least not that they've ever publicly named. However, in a January 1999 interview with the Great Falls Tribune, Lynn shared that her family had at least one person in mind, Jesus Vasquez, the gas station attendant in Deming, who was the last person to have seen Jennifer. Lynn explained, quote, We think he knows something, but he won't come forward and he won't take a lie detector test. End quote. Outside of that one mention, I've not seen this angle discussed anywhere else in all the years since. This year, 2021, will mark 30 years since Jennifer disappeared and 29 since her belongings were found. When last seen, Jennifer Lynn Pentola was described as being a Caucasian female with blonde hair and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighing approximately 120 pounds. Jennifer has a birthmark on her left forearm, a laparotomy scar on her abdomen, and diagonal scars on the tips of her index and middle fingers. She has a gap between her front teeth and wears glasses. Her blood type is O negative. Jennifer was last seen wearing a blue Bum brand sweatshirt over a tank top, denim shorts, socks, brown hiking boots, dog tags with her name and address on them, a friendship bracelet, a silver ring with the words Love Jesus inscribed on it, and a watch with the Rice Krispies character Snap, Crackle, and Pop on the face. She was last seen in Deming, New Mexico on October 17, 1991. Most of her belongings were found 7 miles outside of Hatch, north of State Road 26, though her sleeping bag and bike have never been found. Her bike was a Fuji Sundance, white with green lettering. Her name and a relative's phone number are engraved on the bike, and the serial number is F9101771. If alive today, Jennifer would be 47 years old. For more than 30 years, the mystery of Jennifer's disappearance has haunted her family and the investigators who have worked her case. Outside of the discovery of her belongings, there have never been major developments, never been any real leads. After all this time, the case has grown cold, and while the New Mexico State Police still hold jurisdiction, there has been little, if anything, added to the files, outside of unconfirmed sightings that still come in from time to time. Lynn is now 70 years old, and still maintains some hope that her daughter might be out there somewhere. In a 2016 interview, she explained, quote, "She's deeply missed, and we think of her every day. We just want her back, and she needs to be found." When the cold weather keeps us inside, one of my favorite ways to mentally escape is to curl up and get lost in a show. When the streets are sheets of ice, the wind is howling, and I don't have anywhere I need to be, nothing feels more transportive when I'm stuck indoors than watching brilliant TV from across the pond. I love the different styles of storytelling, hearing things from different perspectives, and being told by people from different places all around the world. That's why I have Acorn TV. Acorn TV is a streaming service that's rooted in British television. It has a rich catalog of exclusive award-winning series across genres, including mysteries, dramas, comedies, and so much more. From production to performances, the series you'll find on Acorn TV are exceptional because they're written cleverly, visually striking, and feature renowned actors like David Tennant and Tandy Newton. If you can't get enough of suspenseful crime dramas, then catch up on Acorn TV original Mystery Road. Hailed a visual knockout by the New York Times, Mystery Road takes place in the stunning Australian outback, where a detective and local cop played by Oscar nominee Judy Davis teams up to investigate the mysterious disappearance of two boys, but solving the case could expose other crimes that haunt the town. The second season just premiered and opens up a new thriller in a town where the desert meets the ocean. Plus, you'll get thousands of hours of new refreshing content on Acorn TV for a fraction of the cost compared to most streaming services at just $5.99 a month. I often watch from my Amazon stick in the living room, or if I'm on the go, right on my laptop. Escape to Britain and beyond without leaving your seat. Try Acorn TV free for 30 days by going to acorn.tv and using my promo code TRACE. That's ACORN.TV, code TRACE, to get your first 30 days for free. Everyone wants to keep their home and family safe. Whether it's from a break-in, fire, flooding, or medical emergency, SimpliSafe Home Security delivers award-winning 24/7 protection. With SimpliSafe, you don't just get an arsenal of cameras and sensors, you get the best professional monitors in the business. They've got your back day and night, ready to send police, fire, or EMTs when you need them most straight to your door. SimpliSafe delivers high-quality equipment that you can set up in minutes. It took me less than 30 minutes to secure my house, and that has provided me with hours of comfort. With SimpliSafe, I receive sensors for doors and windows and cameras to protect every corner of my home. One thing I really love about SimpliSafe is there's no long-term contract required, no hidden fees, and no installation costs. Plus, none of the equipment causes major changes to your home interior, no holes to patch up later, or wires to contend with. Right now, my listeners get a free home security camera when they purchase a SimpliSafe system at simplisafe.com/trace. You also get a 60-day risk-free trial, so there's nothing to lose. Visit simplisafe.com/trace for your free security camera today. That's simplisafe.com/trace. The disappearance of Jennifer Pentola is a sad and challenging case for a number of reasons. There's a lot of contradictory information out there, different locations mentioned, different dates listed, and a lot of unconfirmed sightings that have been included on official websites as though they're definite facts. A lot of the coverage is repeated information from article to article, so finding a confirmed basis for some information proved exceedingly difficult. Perhaps the most frustrating aspect is that at its core, there's very little which is actually known about Jennifer's whereabouts after her October 17th phone call. Different witnesses put her in opposite places. Some say she went north, others south. Some say she mentioned Mexico, others say Minnesota. There's a lot to work through to ultimately come to a point where you have to face the reality that at some time after that call, Jennifer vanished. I can't imagine what it's like for her family having to confront the utter lack of information. Despite all of their efforts and the police officers who were dedicated in their approach to the case, it slowly became a situation where they had to wait for something, be that a tip or a new piece of evidence, and that sadly never came. In the absence of something solid, there's a few theories circulating out there, but not as many as you'd imagine. I think that's due in part to the fact that this case has not received a lot of coverage, at least not as much as you might imagine. Tara Calico disappeared 200 miles to the north of Deming 3 years before Jennifer. Compare the coverage, the known information, and the theories, and you'll see a big contrast. Yet both cases share similarities. Both women were on bikes, which have never been recovered. When it comes down to it, there's three essential theories in this case, and really, they're very similar. Most people believe Jennifer was likely the victim of a homicide, and when it comes to a potential person of interest, they're typically categorized in one of the following ways. Someone she met along the way who pretended to offer her a ride and instead abducted her. Someone who she didn't know at all, who struck in a completely random manner. Or the most notorious killer in New Mexico, who happened to torture his victims less than 60 miles from where Jennifer's belongings were found, David Parker Ray, the so-called toy box killer. Now, before moving into those theories, I did want to address another set of possibilities, ones with a far less sinister intent. Some people believe it's possible that Jennifer's disappearance could have been due to an injury or a fall. There's a lot of abandoned mines in the deserts of New Mexico, and it's been suggested that Jennifer could have set up camp for the night and found herself riding her bike, only to fall into one of those mines. While that's a possibility which can't be ignored, there seems to be some doubt about Jennifer deciding after a long day of riding that she wanted to set up camp and then ride around in the desert. It's certainly not something we have any evidence that she'd done before. By her journal entries, it seems, once she set up camp for the night, that was it. That's where she stayed. In most cases, she decided to set camp near populated areas, be they outside of churches, museums, or at campgrounds made available to travelers. We don't have any reference for her setting up camp in the middle of nowhere, and I'm not quite sure why she would have this time. Las Cruces was just over 60 miles from Deming, and after the first leg of the trip, it was mostly downhill. Jennifer had certainly rode her bike for longer than that in the past. We know she called her mother at approximately 9 a.m. on the 17th, so unless she hung around Deming for several hours, she would have been able to get to Las Cruces by 2, 3, or 4 o'clock. The trip to Hatch through State Road 26 was actually easier, a 4-hour bike ride, mostly downhill. Why would she stop 7 miles from town to set up camp? Rationally, it doesn't make sense, but maybe there could have been a reason. Maybe she was tired or not feeling well or was frustrated. It all comes down to whether or not you believe Jennifer is the one who put her items where they were found, and for the most part, people don't believe that. It seems unlikely that, growing tired, she'd ride her bike more than a couple of miles up a dirt road into the desert to set up a camp. If she did, would she have left all of her prized possessions behind while she took her bike elsewhere? There's been a lot of talk about how the items were found, neatly stacked and covered by her folded tent. If she had stopped there, I just find it hard to believe she'd have taken the items out of her bags and stacked them, then covered them with the tent, rather than just leaving them in her bags where they were already safe. Now, there's been sightings and statements that it's possible she's still living in the area, or made it to California, or went to Mexico. I'm not going to say all that's impossible, but leaving behind her birth certificate, driver's license, and all belongings other than the clothes on her back, her sleeping bag, and her bike seems a bit foolish. She would have left behind a lot of things which would have been incredibly helpful on a journey elsewhere. Most specifically, she left behind a lot of food, water, and a water filtration system. That just doesn't make sense to me. If you stick with the evidence and go only by what can be proven, I don't think there's much to any theories that Jennifer would have run off. At a minimum, I believe had she done so, she'd at least have notified her mother so she didn't spend her next 30 years wondering what became of her. So, if it wasn't an accident, like falling in a mine shaft or down a craggy embankment, if Jennifer didn't go off on her own, the most likely answer is that she became the victim of foul play. Let's begin with the possibility of a random crime. We have no way of knowing what way Jennifer went when she left Deming. She could have taken the southern route heading towards Las Cruces, or she could have taken the northern one on her way to Hatch. There could be a multitude of reasons for each: not wanting to get in trouble for being on the interstate with a bike, not being sure exactly which was the better destination, or just making a wrong turn at some point. We know she made arrangements to stay at a church in Las Cruces, and maybe that's where she meant to go, but we also know she never made it there. Throughout her journal, Jennifer described catching rides with people, getting directions from people. It's entirely possible that this happened here. She meets someone in Deming or on the road out of town, and they offer her a ride. Unfortunately, by the time she realizes this person isn't taking her where she wanted to go, it's too late. If she would have even had the time to notice before someone produced a weapon and held her captive, but we can't really say. That area isn't exactly the greatest of places to be on your own. Those roads are frequented by drug runners and other unsavory types. There's a lot of truckers passing through who could easily have taken her hundreds of miles away. There's even the possibility that it could have been an accident situation where someone struck her with a vehicle and then covered up the crime. I should note, there's also an area nearby known for mountain biking, and we can't completely rule out the possibility that Jennifer could have been targeted by someone who just wanted her bike. We also have to consider if Jennifer did set up camp in that area where her items were found, there's an unofficial dumping site right there, and who knows what kind of people come driving in there at night looking to dump things. If you move out of Random, then you head towards David Parker Ray. Now, I don't want to get into the deep specifics about this horrifying monster. There's plenty of podcasts out there which will give you the terrifying and gory details about the crime. But I imagine many of you already have a familiarity with his story. To sum it up, Ray, or the Toy Box Killer, as he was later known, is estimated to have been committing his atrocious crimes as early as 1950, with it all coming to an end with his arrest in March of 1999. Almost all of his suspected victims were from New Mexico and Arizona, And I say suspected victims because outside of those who survived and testified against him, police have never found a single body. They do, however, theorize he could have been involved in as many as 60 homicides. Ray used a trailer, which he spent more than $100,000 transforming into a horrifying torture chamber. This trailer was located at 513 Bass Road in Elephant Butte, New Mexico. Elephant Butte is just under 60 miles to the northeast of where Jennifer's belongings were found. Many of Ray's victims were taken from areas near Interstate 25, which meets the town of Hatch, just 7 miles from the same location. For many, the sheer proximity makes Ray a likely suspect in this case, and considering the mystery that surrounds the identity of his many victims, I don't think it's completely out of place to consider this possibility. As part of his torture, Ray recorded tapes which would be played for his victims once they regained consciousness. Often they had been struck or drugged and would wake up already in his torture chamber. There's a transcript which exists of tapes Ray recorded in 1993, and honestly, listening to them is horrifying and sickening. However, on side two of tape number one, Ray makes the following statement, quote, "Basically, I guess we are like predators. We're always looking. Occasionally, some sweet little thing will be broke down on the side of the road, walking, bicycling, jogging. Anytime an opportunity like that presents itself and it's not too risky, we'll grab her." End quote. Many people wonder if the reference to bicycling could be a nod to Jennifer. Other people who had committed crimes along with Ray suggested he had taken some victims who were riding bikes. Surely that's possible. We just have no way of knowing if Jennifer was one of them. For what it's worth, the New Mexico State Police did investigate this angle. They later stated they could find nothing to link Ray to Jennifer's disappearance. While that doesn't necessarily mean he wasn't involved, it does throw some questions out there. The FBI is in possession of more than 1,000 pieces of evidence from Ray's arrest, including jewelry and clothing items from victims, as well as a journal in which he kept detailed notes of his victims. He didn't give names, but he did note dates. Nothing matched up to Jennifer. So, unfortunately, there's really no way of knowing if Jennifer could have been one of his victims, the way he was careful with his crimes, so careful that law enforcement has never found evidence to prove even a single murder. It seems unlikely he'd have left all of Jennifer's belongings out there in the desert, not far from where he lived. Unless, of course, he didn't know they were there. It's a piece of this puzzle which may exist, but if it does, I don't know how it will ever be identified, and for Jennifer's sake, I really hope she never crossed Ray's path. So, while Ray is a possibility, there's another which is maybe a little more close to likely. The last confirmed person to speak with Jennifer before her disappearance was Jesus Vasquez, also known as Chewy. While initial reports state that Vasquez told police he remembered Jennifer, talked to her for a few minutes and liked her bike, there didn't seem to be anything there to connect him to her disappearance. He claimed Jennifer said she was heading towards Mexico, though she told her mother just minutes later that she was not going to Mexico, and that caused some confusion. Maybe it was something in the way he spoke, or the fact that he liked Jennifer's bike, which has never been found, that initially aroused suspicion, at least on Lynn's part. We know from Jennifer's journal she had asked gas station employees in the past how far it was to the next city or to a specific location. We know she was very polite and often accepted rides if they were offered. Some have speculated that Vasquez could have offered her a ride and that she may have taken him up on it. Others feel he could have merely given her directions, perhaps the wrong ones, so that he could catch up with her later. The fact seems to be, whoever placed Jennifer's belongings in that spot in the desert was likely familiar with that area, likely knew there was a dumping site nearby, and that sounds more like someone who was around there a lot, not just someone passing through in random. The police have never mentioned Vasquez, though Lynn has made it clear she believes he knows more than he's saying and that he won't take a polygraph. I think, however, for a lot of people, what really makes them consider Vasquez is not his behavior at the time of Jennifer's disappearance, but what happened years later. In October of 2011, when Vasquez was 41 years old, he got into a fight with his brother Frank. By the time police arrived, Frank was unresponsive, and while they managed to get him breathing again, he ultimately passed away. In the end, Vasquez worked out a plea deal where he pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter, receiving a 4-year sentence. So, could a man who beat his own brother to death have been responsible for the disappearance of Jennifer, a woman he is confirmed to have been the last person to see alive? If he did, somehow he's managed to evade any charges all these years. Whether or not police have looked at him closely, consider him someone worth tracking or not, is hard to say. They've never commented, which either means they don't consider him likely, or they do, but they're not going to lay their cards on the table. The sad truth is, when you look at everything you've got, the simplest answer might be the correct one, that Jennifer was targeted by someone she had merely chatted with for a few minutes. Then again, without proof, we really have no way of knowing anything for sure. But I really look forward to hearing what you think. It's a tragic story, beginning to end. An 18-year-old high school graduate with strong faith and a deep desire to help others vanishes, traveling the American South on her bike. Of all the places in the world she had been, of all the people she had helped and wanted to help, everything was cut short in a perplexing and frustrating mystery which has endured for more than 30 years. Police, despite the lack of information, do believe there are people who were in the area at the time who know what happened to Jennifer. It's just a question of whether or not they'll ever come forward. Sadly, without new tips, new evidence, or finding Jennifer herself, her disappearance will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Jennifer Pentola, a lot of newspaper articles from the Missoulin and the Deming Headlight shine light on the case. There is also an old website which was dedicated to the case and shared a lot of police files, though it's no longer accessible. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jennifer Pentola, please contact the Missoula Police Department at 406-552-6303. You can also contact the New Mexico State Police at 575-546-6631. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without the support of amazing listeners like you. Now I'd like to take a moment to thank our amazing Patreon producers. Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, D'Arthy, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, James, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kevin Bonham, Marla Wright, Melissa Breckeisen, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Roberta Jansen, Quinn McBreen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Sepsko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, getting cool merch, and having access to commercial-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. That's going to conclude episode 144, The Disappearance of Jennifer Pentola. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.